Department of Correctional Service in terms of attracting the professional doctors and nurses and nurses? And if yes, how? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. We heard this morning that somebody else who talked to us was talking about the need for the medical profession itself to help develop, if you like, protocols or regulations that would assist the practitioners in applying whatever rules were appropriate in determining whether somebody was in qualified for medical parole. And when we raised this with the person who was talking to us, he said, well, he didn't know that he wasn't a doctor, but we've got a doctor here. So I was just wondering whether those protocols exist. In other words, where one is able to say with a degree of certainty that you've gone as far as the medical profession can go as far as curative care is concerned, and from here on it's just palliative care. Whether it's possible to develop those protocols in such a way that they could be taken up into regulations that would then place the granting of medical parole in a sense beyond simply the discretion or the opinion of an individual doctor or panel of doctors, but place it in a place where you could tell with a degree of certainty that the person was indeed now beyond curative care.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I also want to commend the South African Association for presenting this in to us. My concern is one, are we going to get new doctors, or we are having enough doctors in South Africa? Because as it stands now, the short of doctors. In the department, physio, wherever, we are short of doctors. Now, if we deal with this issue, are we going to get more doctors who will be able to assist? And my second question, if this medical association is going to assist correctional or detainee or inmate or those who are on trial. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Let me add my two cents. Well, I am offended if you be supportive of the idea that the minister must we had an argument about a doctor that is the employer of the department and for a GPM panel. But at the same time, we spoke about specialist disciplines. Are you suggesting that these panels are made up of specialist disciplines? A group of nine provinces and therefore nine bodies? We accept that they all work every day, but I think the alignment and the question then is, do we have so many people at our disposal, one? And two, there could be a whole variety of potential, or even have a specialist neurosurgeon or whatever you call it, a specialist heart, a specialist. Earlier this morning we said when we take it, one, they must be practical and implementable, and two, they must be cost effective for the department. So when you propose in these questions, what are the top indications, and two, do we have them very near? You are free to respond.
Thank you.
principles that need to be applied in order to get that to that diagnosis. Not diagnosis, but that terminology. If it's not in existence, then clearly one will need to develop those, and there need to be very clear guidelines along with which possibly the panel could use in terms of decision making. To speak to whether there are enough doctors at a practical level, I think when you're looking at cost, you don't want to go and establish huge committees and have huge expenditure incurred as a result. One of the ideas I'm thinking of putting there is possible public-private partnerships, where there's a potential to actually see if one can utilize resources on either side in a cost-effective way to be able to set up a panel that would have specialists on that panel, almost like accredited individuals who are put on the panel. You could have one person per kind of specialty, but they won't be involved in every case. There would be a need for the specialty to be involved depending on the case as is needed. So I'm not sure if I'm talking to what you're talking about practically, but my understanding of if you're trying to make sure that you are not duplicating expenditure, so by setting up these panels, that you have a strategic way in which you design the panel, that it's a standardized way that's cost effective, that it has clear protocols in order when it comes to decision making, and with those clarity, one can take it forward.
So you've got to know this and then understanding the fear of Thank you very much. We will take whatever you give us and use that for the department on Thursday and with everybody else. As we go along, so to the South African Medical Association, thank you very much. Can we then ask Ms. Pagliacci? You could take the floor, please.
Thank you, Chair. Very good afternoon to everyone. Regarding the micro submission, I mean, I've been sitting this morning and there's lots of issues that have come up. So, yeah, I have a question. So I'm going to raise some of those issues here that is not in the presentation, which gives micro viewpoint. But as you know, with this submission, which is a very different angle and didn't go close by close and talk about each specific. And I think I just wanted to use the opportunity to just reiterate some underlying issues. So we actually, as NICO, welcome the amendments to the Patient Services Act, specifically relating to the new medical parole system, provisions for management and detention of the monitoring and other methods. With regard to this presentation, I draw particular attention to the distinctive management regime for remand detainees, given that DCS thus far has been responsible for management of sentenced offenders, and now have been assigned human detainment just to reiterate the distinct management regime that's required. I also raised issues regarding legal aid that I'm going to touch on, risk classification of human detainment, alternative direct imprisonment, education and other support services work in labor, which is an extra monitoring mechanism for the maximum period of incarceration. Remand detention facilities and police cells and other lockup facilities being included in that. So we can further touch on that. Obviously, budget and training is a major issue regarding the management of the remand detention. And then I also raise very specialized issues like violence and rape in remand detention facilities, but it's also, I think, an issue that we've heard for the largest sentence population as well. As well as the issue of medical parole, particularly what happens when the offender is released on medical parole and the burden of the medical expenses and thereafter for the family and those kinds of implications. And then really importantly the issue of mental health, mentally ill inmates, and then the issue of drugs and alcohol in correctional facilities. Now I heard this morning, Mr. Chair, that you did say we are going to talk about the larger act at some point. So some of them may be relevant to the amendments and others. So regarding the management and detention of remand detainees, I mean, it's clear that obviously these are people that are presumed innocent until proven guilty, and I think we all stay clear on that. But I just wanted to reiterate that when you are looking beyond amendments, what the DCS will now give in terms of budget around managing this population, that there is a distinctive regime to manage it, and that is different to how you manage them. So it's just much more leading information around how we contextualize this particular task force. And obviously, we're very pleased that finally the waiting and trial and remand detainees have been assigned. For some time, they weren't sure where and who would be, whether it was the Department of Justice or who's responsible for it would be. And in line of how DCS has managed the sentence population, obviously they are concerned. Last year there were lots of challenges that we looked at when we looked at the sentence population in terms of overcrowding, staff capacity limitations. We've heard now about specialized and dedicated capacity like doctors and medical staff, poor and mutant women in prison conditions. And we have to bear all of that in mind as we go into looking at the management of remand detainees. I'm not going to go through all that's in 2.1.1 in terms of remand detainees requiring alternative management regime. I think I've read a lot from Coyle, who talks about a human-like approach to prison management, and obviously there they give a lot of attention to management of pre-trial prisoners. appropriate that the judicial, when people are sent to a retrial under mine detention, they are not supposed to be declared, they're supposed to have their liberty and not be subjected to any additional punishment. Hence, they are not being held in prison as a punishment, which is something that we have to bear in mind. Many instances of mine detaining are found in prison when their cases come to trial, and the unconvicted state that is reflected in their treatment must be reflected in their treatment and management. And it does require a mindset change that is not clearly captured, that I found in the act of the amendment. And I'm sure in regulations or in the strategies that the DPS will present will become less clear. But as the judge said, if there are things that are necessary to put and to regulate in the act, then we need to identify those issues. And a limitation of my presentation is that it doesn't specifically identify those. In terms of Section 49A, we saw the different subcategories of offenders that speak further regulation than the amendment. And I think we need to bear in mind that remand detainees, as the system comes out, is a wide, diverse range of people. And looking at women, youth, and children, although children should not be in those facilities, but still they are held in other facilities. But if we include persons after disappearance, detained for trial, detained for psychiatric observation, awaiting statements at the psychiatric facility, children awaiting statements for use in child and youth care center. And then I know here to talk about foreign nationals, but once again, the lawyers is concerned for me that the DCF does not just people who are waiting extradition in the facilities. I'm not sure if it happens, but I know in Dela where the Home Affairs Department manages them. So I do apologize for that hindsight because I haven't included it here, as they should not be detained for people that are charged with criminal offenses. But just in terms of knowing that as well. Obviously, this routine has also referred to lots about unsentenced prisoners having more wider freedoms and that sort of thing. But, and what I'm basically saying there is that it's almost like there's a specialized management approach for each particular category, in other words. Now, we know with the rating, the mind detaining as well, the judicial process is often slower, and one has to also bear in mind the emotional impact of being detained for the first time, and what possible behavior that mind detaining is likely to show. They may have a legitimate sense of grievance, they may affect their behavior, and correctional officials obviously need to be trained in how to handle people are coming into prison for the first time, for instance, and I'm not sure whether that is always given adequate attention. We have many instances of people who are first-time offenders, young offenders who are actually targeted in remand detention facilities, and I don't see that it gives enough attention to those vulnerable people. So admissions processes need to take into consideration how they're going to manage this particular group. And there should be separate set of rules for the management of remand detainees that should be improved, but maybe there's a need for additional. And prison staff should be clear in their minds the legal distinction between convicted and remand detainees, and I'm not sure if that's always the case. Now we know, obviously, I'm not going to go into the living conditions and the style of a remand detention facility, which is said to approximate that of life outside the prison center, which is quite broad. I mean, the UN standard minimum rule even says that untried prisoners should sit singly and in separate rooms. And we know in our overcrowded facilities it's not possible, but it is said to be a UN standard minimum rule. So that's an issue that needs a question mark. One also needs to consider the immediate consequence of separation for the remand detainees in the past has been worse than remand detention facilities are obviously more overcrowded, most overcrowded. They have the worst accommodation and are given least access to facilities and treatment. There's a lot of we often get complaints of neutral from inmates regarding the quality of the legal aid service and the long delays, and sometimes that they are afforded a substandard service. We do live in that, however, that in the past few years, much attention has been given to improving legal aid in the country, yet it is still a serious area needing attention, particularly because the right to legal representation is a right guaranteed by the Constitution. So it's just that an area that needs to be highlighted in terms of how we're going to look at strategies regarding that. Then also in terms of, I've just been inquiring once again from the lawyers in the room about prompt access to legal representation. In this country, we don't have a guarantee for that. You can see on page 5, the principal data control and role of lawyers. Talks about having prompt access to a lawyer in any case not more than 48 hours from the time of arrest or detention. Now, for that people, we don't have those time periods, but apparently we do have some provision for certain stages of the criminal process for the right to legal representation being afforded. But it's still a problem, and I just want to bring my aspect to the issue. Then, in terms of risk application of remand detainees, in Coyle's investigation, he also found justification for holding those who are awaiting trial on relatively minor crimes, that they should not be held in the same conditions as those who have been charged with the ECA. Now, we know that our sentence population is a classification methodology, and I'm not sure how practical it is to classify the mind detainees, but you are getting the mind detainees. With the exception of children being removed, you're often getting petty offenders mixing with more serious criminals. And this is an area that I don't know how practically we're going to address, but even internationally, it's an area that people have addressed, and categories of risk have been applied to the modern teams as well. So, something like that you can consider here. So, another area that we need to look at. In regard to overcrowding, and I think that is the whole issue of the overcrowding, demand detention, and the impact of incarceration, and most importantly, alternatives to direct detention. And I think some of the speakers earlier alluded to that fact as well, that there are some people who are being given in demand detention, although there are sentences that can be afforded as jurors justice options. Where things can happen pre-trial, and especially for petty offenders and offenders, and major, as much as we are asking the judicial know, and once again, the annual report on the situation has set to bring our attention always to the incarcerated and other overcrowded cell up to 20 hours a day. And we really need to look at, in terms of the environment, tension, inmates that are not entitled to these kinds of services, that obviously something can be done with them. They do not qualify for the full option of programs available to sentence offenders. But currently, in the absence of it being regulated, there are organizations and not governmental organizations, particularly working with remand detention. And they create programs that deal with the, you know, there's a high turnover when people can go to facilities, people can't go. But they designed programs that can target people that, you know, are not there for long periods of time. We really need to look at that and see how we can regulate that a bit more if they have access to these types of programs. With regard to work and labor, I mean, obviously, offenders in a waiting class doesn't are required to make in terms of exercise and what they should be doing, they are required to maintain the cleanliness of their cells as well as their own personal hygiene. They may also be permitted to perform other labor. But as Munchin points out, there is no regulation to explain what this means. In the UN standards and rules, they refer to untried prisoners shall be afforded opportunity to work, but shall not be required to work with an option. And if they choose to work, they shall be paid. According to Coyle, considerations about work we know apply first to those who are convicted. But he states that there are different considerations that apply in respect of those who are in trial. Since they are not found guilty, they shouldn't be obliged to work, but they are often misled and may suffer from boredom over long hours of the monotony, sometimes for years. So work should be made available for them and they should be encouraged to take part. Similarly, with regard to exercise, there's been recommendations of them, remand detainees encouraged to play sport and be involved in engaging in recreational facilities and other activities. And that's once again in terms of the whole management regime that DCS is undertaking, that those kinds of considerations be taken on board. In terms of the monitoring time related to the maximum incarceration period, obviously we know that this gives attention to the slow judicial process that results in many remand detainees waiting for long periods pre-trial. But yet we do know, even in this country in terms of our local legislation, that anyone arrested or detained in a criminal charge shall be brought promptly before a judge or other officer. So it's really encouraging to see now there's a maximum period, but I guess the real test lies in how this is managed in terms of the monitoring. And as part of the process, we need to ensure the continuing legitimacy of the detention section 49G that stipulates the monitoring requirements or arrangements between DCS and the court. And it does require criminal authorities to maintain accurate records so that remand detainees are not locked within the judicial system. Now, given the whole issue of maintenance of secure records that was raised last year as an issue of concern, it is an area also that needs to be monitored by the country in terms of the records with regard to this maintenance area. I'll give you two case studies that I'm not going to go into, but it's interesting how internationally people deal with remand detainees. And interestingly enough, in Honduras, if people are not do not come to trial in the required time and exceed the maximum prison sentence for trial and officially accused, they may be released. Anyway, with regard to section 2.1.10, this with regard to the police, the remand detention facilities and police lockup, police and lockup facilities also being deemed remand detention facilities. Like it has been raised earlier in terms of the monitoring of those facilities and who actually is a remand detention official, do they only apply to those in the correctional environment? In terms of police, they also monitor that, and I think that issue has come up over and over again. And it's really an area that needs regulation in terms of police cells, particularly of what goes on in police cells and court cells, high incidence of assault, physical and
Thank you.
we are saying that correctional spirit is supposed to correct people's behavior. Many offenders have a substance addiction, a substance abuse problem, and it's less punitive. Instead of gangs that are actually running the prisons, smuggling drugs into the system, we heard how very often it happens at court cells where drugs are smuggled. Police cells, they often use vulnerable young offenders to insert the drugs into the anus of these people, which is also gay. And at the same time, there's a whole different answer. Interestingly, what it says is that the presence of drugs in the correctional facility is known by the people. It's known by officials, and they say the best case scenario is that the official knows it about it and ignores it. The worst case scenario is that the officials are smart about the drug smuggling that does happen. And it's a serious issue. It's happening. It's a proper nation. And they even said that even through the piggery in Yakunsing, through the pigs going into the kitchens of the DCS, drugs were being smuggled. And I don't ever hear the DCS addressing these issues. And it also talks about the management of the prison system. The inmates are in control. If this is what's going on, and they're allowing things to come in and out of our prisons. So it's a serious implication for DCS in terms of its management. And if we don't start addressing these as special issues that need to be done, then we're wasting our time because as a result of this, there's so much of violation, violence, and all of that. Okay, so that basically sums up. I know it's not specifically giving recommendations regarding this, but hopefully it just opens up our mind in terms of how we engage with the amendments, how we relate to engage with the principal act, and then in terms of the budget and the regulations around the amount of change.
Thank you much, Minister. Comments? Are you on site? Mr. Patel, followed by Mr. Ngwenya, the others that have not participated the whole day, I'm not sure. But Mr. Patel, again, Mr. Ngwenya.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for those comments. Can I just underscore what you said about the classification of the non-detainees? So I can remember on a oversight of the King Williams Archives, one of the staff members complaining there that whereas all sentences of them were classified in terms of the offences they committed, nobody was classifying awaiting trial detainees if they were then known in terms of the crimes for which they had been arrested. And so, and even those that had previous convictions, so you could get somebody who was there for housebreaking but had previously been convicted of multiple murders, and the staff themselves were then not in a position to, they felt at risk from highly violent people who were being detained awaiting trial without any particular protection or anything else. And so it's not only for the detainees that are at risk, it's also the staff that are at risk. And I think it's something that we now need to look at in terms of when we deal with it for such a system. The second thing that I'd like to pick up is the thing about mentally ill inmates. I mean, I 100% agree that they should not be incarcerated and that they should be referred to other facilities. The question is, what other facilities? We know how what the waiting list is for converted and mental care. Where are you going to put them? And, you know, if you can't put them there, what else do you do with them if they're not incarcerated? Question I don't have an answer
for. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Chair, the presentation is clear, and also I think we call to take this opportunity to raise all their frustrations in this document, detainees that are awaiting trial, which is that are staying long in our centers,
seek the opportunity again in terms of the criticism that they must be given an opportunity to work. But I think that one chair needs to be discussed, that our act allow us to do so. Because there are many factors and that we cannot control a person if it's not a second. You can say I must work, and I can tell you that I cannot work because I'm not yet second. So it's a difficult decision to tell someone who are not yet present to say go and work. They also get the opportunity to talk about foreign national prison. That's why I said this opportunity, they did use it to raise all their frustration. And I think that maybe in our next situation, we need to talk about this thing, although I understand that it's falling under Home Affairs. But sometimes it also affects the correctional centers. But it's our cluster. We'll look at it. There's nothing more that I can say, but I can say that the document is good, is going to assist us to make this deal effective. I thank you.
Hi, Donkey Worship. Chairperson, unfortunately, if one looks through the bill, there is nothing there which talks about the issues, especially the latter part of the presentation, going to be the whole issue of drugs and substance abuse. Chairperson, I don't know in what way can one address this. Firstly, we have a society where respect for one another is gone. I grew up in a situation where I got my last very good hiding from my late dad when I was 18, because I did something wrong. For those of you who know my answer, for those few moments, Jefferson, I thought that I had the most cruel father in the world. But after an hour or two, I said, thank God I had a father like that. Jefferson, what I'm trying to convey is that when I visit some of these facilities, the last one I visited, I was told that a terrible crime was committed by six people, where the one guy actually got the other five together, and they went on a little spree. It was drinking and dacha smoking and things like that, and they decided we're going to go somewhere and loot them and get money or whatever, and in the process killed three people. Jefferson, many of the inmates that we have in our facilities, I don't know if the judge would agree because he sees more facilities than we do, visits more of them than we do, I would venture to say that a overwhelming number of those people that are there, especially those that are under 45, are people that are hooked on drugs. No amount of legislation, no amount of incarceration or peddling in substances of abuse and things like that is going to help our society. The correctional facility, Chairperson, is in many instances not a correctional facility. When they come out of there, many of them are hooked on these be even worse than what they were when they went in. Chairperson, we need in our society something drastic that needs to be done. And when I spoke at the recent funeral, after the funeral, to large numbers of people, my suggestion was that it is necessary that we get together at community level across cultural, religious, class lines, and that we start holding gatherings and meetings across those lines to bring home to our young people these dangers that we are facing. When we were young, Jefferson, we never heard of a youngster at school raping somebody's daughter. Those things never happened. But it's happening today. So we need to look for the root causes. Otherwise, Jefferson, all these things that we are trying to achieve here are, to my mind, not remedial measures. We are not going to be able to remedy anything unless we address the root causes of this problem. Why do these things happen? In short, Jefferson, we need to have somewhat a code. And if, for example, there is assistance, I mean, somebody assists the inmate inside the walls of the facility, and that somebody is normally a person who is supposed to be a person of authority. Unless there is a issue from whistle that, nobody is going to be able to bring the drugs to the day. Nobody will take a chance. We need to have some other code here that if any of our correctional services official is found to be assisting with drugs, yeah, it's a pity, you know, we have a constitution which has outlawed certain procedures that are followed in other countries. But that person that peddles drugs is a mass murderer. That person should be removed permanently from society. That person should be incarcerated in some, well, you know, one minister at one time said that we must use the mine shafts as jails, turn them into jails. That person belongs to such a place. Because they are busy destroying the future generations. In conclusion, Chair, we need to remind correctional services that they need to tell us what can be done on their part to root out the peddling of drugs in those facilities. Nobody must tell me, Chairperson, that it's impossible to do so. The word impossible belongs in the dictionary of food. The only thing that is impossible is something that God has created which you cannot do. Everything else which is human-made, human beings peddling drugs, can be stopped. And they need to come out with a national war plan that this is how they are going to stop drugs in the facilities. Just this morning there was a report, Chair, that there is a effort here in the Western Cape to take out all these gangsters that are involved in the heists and murders and things. And they arrested, some people last night or something. So if we want to do something, it can happen. We want correctional services to take note of this. This
moments ago, the first question from the floor, that in fact in Act Section 66 says on the admission the National Commissioner must make preliminary security classification of an inmate. In fact, applied before the proposed amendments in the law. So if it wasn't done in Grahamstown, the address on the National Commissioner's law, that actually he offers the information and a particular procedure. You may not have all the information, that might be at courts or the police generally, but there is such a clause in the legislation. Chairperson, honourable members, members of organisations, thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to try and curtail my presentation quite substantially. I'm going to do as little repetition as possible to highlight a few things which do need to be addressed, and my colleague Patricia McCourty will specifically address the issues pertaining to medical parole that have not already been touched on. I think primarily to highlight practical issues, try and resolve some, raise some questions. I'm not going to necessarily say where the draft has got it right. I will echo earlier comments. Primarily, I'll deal with clause 1A and B, the definition of inmate and remand detainee. A new aspect which hasn't been addressed is clause 6C, inclusion of restorative justice requirements. I will once again just comment briefly on the closing proposal in clause 9. Also deal with information and records quite briefly, that is the proposed section 49. Terminally ill, remand detainee. Just once again, very briefly, just touch on the release to SAS for further investigation. I think there's one or two points that needs to be made there. And then deal with a new issue which nobody has touched on thus far, is the maximum incarceration period proposed in clause 9, is 49G, the new one. Let me just say from the outset that the impression must not be created that Department of Correctional Services have only recently become responsible for remand detainees. In fact, it's been sitting on their doorstep for many years. A number of years ago, I attended a workshop where DCS almost denied that they were responsible for it, but the closer reading of the legislation clearly made them accountable for it. So I'm very hesitant when I enter these waters, because I know DCS for a number of years has wanted the responsibility to be shifted. That is a bit of a background. However, what the new legislation does is introduce a new regime. Remand detainee centres for remand detention and correctional centres for sentence detainees. This is in the context of budgetary constraints that not only affects DCS, but also affects other departments as well. Department of Health, for example, and if they have to be responsible for care and treatment of former remand detainees or former offenders in the community, suddenly they've got additional financial burden. And I don't suppose DCS is going to get money over every time such an offender comes to the Department of Health. Obviously, the new regime will come with financial costs. If you create a new structure, you need personnel to pull the structure. And I believe some personnel have already begun pulling the structure. There's additional costs. A new branch will require new centres, new personnel, and just against the competing interests of the other departments. Let me just use an example. There are 450 court centres across the country. Are there sufficient remand detention facilities to serve each of these? As I understand, there are already only less than 10 remand detention facilities identified at this point in time. Correctional services facilities that are going to be converted. How does the detainee who goes and appears in the Northern Cape, how is he going to be transported to the nearest detention facility if he has to appear important knowledge, for example, in court? Suddenly you've got huge logistic implications with additional implications, for example, SAS. They remain responsible for transportation, suddenly they've got a huge distance to cover. Let me use the example of Potchefstroom. Potchefstroom has become a remand detention facility. I think it's pushed the
who's taking the big risk? That. They've got two groups of individuals in the 50s which are not guarded with the security requirements that remind attention to the facility. So, Kinshasa. Kinshasa has remind attention to the facility when I registered there and there's no space. No room for female detainees. We are the house, they are houses, London. I do have to get to court, it's at least a 2.5 hour drive, or 2 hour drive. They've got to be taken from entering London all the way through to Kinshasa. Who's carrying the costs? About the police. What happens if somebody in Kinshasa wants to go and visit their wife or mother? They suddenly have to go all the way to East London. So there are huge financial implications following these particular decisions. I ask the question, is the new legislative regime regarding remand detention facilities necessary? In the latter section 3.5c of the Act, which empowers the National Commission to stretch the Department of Justice required, I submit it's not necessary. In the past, DPS was dealing with remand detainees, looking out for remand detainees. Why is it necessary to bring in legislation to go and govern it? The National Commissioner could have decided, well, let's structure ourselves as a branch which takes care of it. Why the new whole legislative regime? Secondly, the proposal does not address the sharing of existing facilities. If there are only going to be 9 or 10 remand detention facilities, what happens in the small towns? Currently, you have sentence defenders and remand detainees in the same facility. You can structure one place. But the Act doesn't talk anything about sharing those remand detention facilities. What does one do in the small towns? How does one adequately serve the small towns? What about the transitional period? There doesn't seem to be a provision for this. It seems like you're either a remand detainee or you're a sentence defender. What happens in the interim when there is no remand detention facility? Where are your house? There's nothing. The Act is, the draft bill doesn't address this. Another issue, or practical challenge which I see, is that over community corrections officers. At this point in time, the Criminal Procedure Act permits people to be released on bail, and as one of the conditions, placed under the supervision of a probation or correctional official. This is the F of the Criminal Procedure Act. You may have and received a number of reports on 53F. Those community correctional officials also serve parole detainees. Who manages them? Who controls them? What happens if there's a shortage of them? Who gets the priority if they are called correctional officials as opposed to remand detainee officials? What will happen? Quite naturally, the one who is owner of them gets the priority. Case of if you want food or you want accommodation, what are you going to serve us for food? So if correctional services is paying you and that's on whose books you are, who are you going to neglect? You're going to neglect the remand you're paying. All of these aspects, the legislation is silent upon. In my mind, it is a big criminal. Let me climb into the definitions. And sorry, honourable members, if you could try to follow in terms of the document that we compiled. But because I'm going to be getting through it, only highlighting those important things, that's something that you may want to read separately. The definition of inmate, the definition of remand detainee are tied together. And as I indicated earlier, an opportunity has been lost to resolve and simplify the definitions in the legislation. Apart from inmate and remand detainee, the legislation refers to offender, sentenced offender, unsentenced offender, and it even uses the words persons awaiting trial or sentence. So we have a whole number of categories. Inmate being quite a broad category that includes sentenced offenders, unsentenced offenders, and remand detainees, but only for specific purposes. However, unsentenced offenders may also be remand detainees up until the point of their conviction in terms of the new definition. Let me repeat, there's three categories. A remand detainee under conviction, then after conviction, that person is termed an unsentenced offender, no longer a remand detainee, and after sentence, that person is referred to as a sentenced offender. We have classification that doesn't
where he says remote detention facilities for remote detainees, correctional centers for sentence offenders, but nothing for unsentenced offenders. In terms of the Act, sentence offenders must be kept separate from unsentenced offenders. That's quite clear. Something needs to be done in the definition to make sure that we don't have this missing category which is housed nowhere. One of the peculiarities regarding extension of the definition as a remand detainee to respect of the definition inmate, why is section 5 of the Act excluded? This deals with establishment of correctional centers and remand detention facilities. In my mind, when you refer to inmates, in the definition of section 5 should be included and not excluded. I ask the next question, why is section 35, 117, 119 and 121 of the existing Act excluded in the definition of inmate? Included in the definition of the word inmate. None of those sections in fact use the word inmate. So it doesn't make sense to say, well, for the purposes of those sections, when the word inmate is not in fact used. Let me deal with the definition of remand detainment. We haven't dealt with it in much detail, although we have alluded to the challenge earlier. This means a person, and I'll take it step by step, in a remand detention facility. So that's the first defining point. A person has to be in a remand detention facility. That means the person is in a correctional center or a police cell. He or she is not a remand detainee. They're excluded from that definition. Second point, awaiting the finalization of his or her trial. Question is, when is this trial finalized? And the definition is that until being convicted or acquitted. Remember that a trial is not finalized as a conviction up until the point of sentence. So we have a problem with the definition. To my mind, we need to, as I said a few moments ago, include the person who is awaiting sentence in the definition of remand detainment. Next clause in this particular definition says, inclusive of the period during which the conviction or acquittal are subject to review or appeal. I don't know why acquittal is here, because one would expect that you wouldn't be in remand detention once you get acquitted. So that, to my mind, that clause should come out. During the period which, and then you leave the word acquittal out, during the period which the conviction is subject to review or appeal. Few issues arise. One, appeals may take an inordinately long period of time. You can appeal all the way to the Constitutional Court. And in terms of the definition as it currently reads, that means if you file your appeal on time, you are still subject to that period. And you can appeal all the way to the Constitutional Court, take 6 years of it, and in terms of the definition, you'll still be classified as a remand detainee. Surely that cannot be the intention of the doctors. Appeals technically must be filed within 14 days. However, upon condemnation, that period can be substantially longer. A recent appellate division report, which fortunately wasn't successful, but some 7 years after conviction and sentence, the appellant filed notice to appeal. So you can see the long period that applies there. Appeals should generally be finalized, should be filed after sentence and not after conviction. So where this clause says inclusive of the period during which the conviction is subject to appeal or review is problematic, because it's the sentence that's the critical point where a person can apply for appeal, and it's also the sentence which kicks in the automatic review process. For example, automatic review of a magistrate, depending on your year's experience, will automatically on review your sentence if it exceeds a period of 3 months or 6 months. So what in effect this provision would mean is that I can be a remand detainee and serve my entire sentence as a remand detainee, because if the review takes more than a 3 month period, then that period is going to expire while I'm still a remand detainee. So the definition has a number of challenges that, therefore, if that person has not commenced serving such sentence, is not really serving a prior sentence. The distinction between people having commenced sentence and not is, to my mind, a artificial distinction. It is better for the convicted defendant person to start serving the sentence as soon as possible. This might also mean that what happens is the other processes relating to reduction of sentence kick in. Suddenly, if I've got a 3-month sentence, I may be automatically be released into correctional supervision. In terms of the bill, clause 12, which proposes 73.7b. So suddenly, coming out of life, and I'm automatically released. Therefore, to my mind, people, the moment they sentence, should go to a correctional centre and not a remand detention facility. They go to a remand detention facility, that facility suddenly starts doing all the things that a correctional facility would do. A correctional centre would go and work out the discount, see if the person's entitled to parole. Suddenly you've got a duplication of functions. And the remand detention facility and it has happened at the correctional centre. Finally, if the accused person who's been convicted of sentence is taken in as a correctional centre, already treatment and rehabilitation but remand detention facility, we know that does not happen. I have proposed in the document a definition, a rather complex one. A person detained in a remand detention facility awaiting the finalisation of his or her trial, whether by acquittal or conviction and sentence, excluding any subsequent appeal or review process. Quite a long definition. However, to my mind, it can be quite short. I propose the following definition: an unsentenced person detained in a remand detention facility. Simple as that. They can be detained up to that particular point in time. And I'm not going to touch on in my submission on the two other aspects, persons liable to extradition and so forth. Let me deal with clause 6C that includes restorative justice. Once clause 6C introduces restorative justice into the Act, it will read as follows. As soon as possible after admission as a sentenced offender, such offender must be assessed to determine his or her, and in Jay comes in, restorative justice requirements. However, this section uses restorative justice contrary to the, and I'm glad one of the members raised it, to the JCPS Trusted Understanding. The definition of restorative justice given in a recent presentation to the JCPS Trusted is that defined as approach to justice that aims to involve parties to a dispute and others affected by the harm, victims, offenders, families concerned, and community members, in collectively identifying harms, needs, and obligations through accepting responsibility, making restitution, taking measures to prevent a recurrence of the incident. The goal is to put right the harms caused by their offense, to heal victims, offenders, and communities that have been injured by their crime. Inclusion of this brings a totally different meaning to the concept of restorative justice. And to my mind, it is also not necessary in Article Section 38.1a of the Act, where one of the requirements is to look at the social function, changing the offender behaviour that already has what is intended, which is to restore the convicted person, the offender, to a more honourable member of society that's not going to fall into the same trap. So to my mind, this inclusion of restorative justice is inappropriate. Clause 9, which includes the clause section 48 dealing with clothing, I make the point in the submission that must should be deleted and rather provisions relating to the word may should be included. I just mainly try to work out, well, what would it cost? If there's an average of 50,000 detainees and we gave them only 3 uniforms a week, you'd have to have multiple sizes. Probably have to replace it on an ongoing basis. So maybe if you needed 250,000 uniforms and it costs 10 rand, it's 2.5 million, not much. If it costs 100 rand for a uniform, well, that's 25 million. Suddenly, the sum would go up. And if we allow them to appear in court in this uniform,
Well, then it's something police have to take responsibility for getting uniforms back from those who are released on bail or acquitted of the case. And bearing in mind, the accusers are also going to take their clothes before being take their clothes back. If you stay on the release from the remand detention facility, they just hand in their uniforms and get their court clothes. I'm going to say, well, when are their court clothes being washed? Because they would have exchanged that on arrival, unless they keep that in addition. So there is an artificial distinction that ultimately creates it. If I'm in such detention and I go to court, I'll be in my private clothes. If I'm on bail, I'll be in my private clothes. However, if I'm incarcerated in a remand detention facility, suddenly I've got a uniform. So it depends where you put the conversion point from uniform to clothes. So, to my mind, we must think very carefully of the practical implications of this. In theory, very nice, great, but the volumes that we deal with make it impractical. And I know from the example I posed earlier, Johannesburg remand detention facility is a good old country. The numbers that they deal with in the morning, they can barely cope with existing staff to just get the people booked up and sent to court. If we now have to add facilities for people to change into private clothes, it's just simply going to delay the process. It's going to delay the courts, that means there's going to be a longer period of incarceration. In respect also to clause 9, the section dealing with information and records and access to it, perhaps I can just throw out the considerations. How should a government department access this information? Will it hinder identification of persons by the Department of Home Affairs, whether they're foreigners or not? Will it hamper steps in the investigation of cases? And will it hinder medical attention, or specialist medical attention? Those are some of the factors which the drafters may have to consider. Let me deal with Article 9, Section 49E. Interesting that this chapter actually deals with remand detainees and remand detention facilities. Yet in 49E, it brings in the words again, or correctional centre. I'm not certain why suddenly we have a little bit of circular reading and suddenly we brought in correctional centre. Yeah? That's where the oversight perhaps was intentional. Certainly ill or incapacitated remand detainees is essentially modelled, to my mind, on Section 63A of the Criminal Procedure Act. The challenge I find is this. The head of the detention facility brings the application to court. The head of the detention facility isn't party to the proceedings. The proceedings are between the accused and the prosecution, with the judicial officer as an independent arbiter of facts. Now we have a procedure whereby the head of the prison suddenly becomes the officer of the facts. Secondly, the Criminal Procedure Act governs the issue of bail in much detail. It echoes the Constitution. Every person arrested for allegedly committing an offence has the right to be released from detention if the interest of justice permits. The Criminal Procedure Act specifically provides in Section 169F for the health of persons to be considered. So we've got a Criminal Procedure Act which says consider the health. I would bring in another section which creates a separate procedure also to deal with the health of and furthermore, the court is obliged at every appearance to consider the issue of a warrant of detention. That is obviously the basis on which a person can be detained. The warrant of detention is issued by the court. So at each court appearance, the presiding officer, in any event, looks whether the accused should be released or not, or issues a warrant of detention. So why would we, do we need this legislation? Second issue that I do have is the proposal in the bill removes the court from examining the view of the medical officer. You only get to look at the view of the head of the prison. The view of the head of the prison will carry significantly less weight than the report of the medical officer. If you remove the court from determining that particular factor, and remember, in terms of the Constitution and the Criminal Procedure Act, the assessment of whether it is in the interest of justice to release the particular person is the criteria that the court must use. So now you weaken the particular evidence that the court will consider or the facts that the court will consider, and you also remove the court from the position of in fact inquiring into the details of the medical report. The medical report doesn't need to go to court in terms of the legislation. And if the court is unable to assess
where the release is in the interest of justice. In the case of serious offences, which are listed in the computer, it is obliged to pay the person. You haven't achieved what you ultimately wanted to achieve. Let me move on to release. Yes. I have
looking at the note, but that's going to be
two more pages. Let me briefly refer to release to status in the custody of status. I think the ultimate concern here is effective control. And to my mind, you don't need legislation to ensure effective control. You simply need a procedure and rules. Currently, we release people to status custody every day for torture. Why can it not be any different when we release them into status custody for other reasons? There might be court sanctioned reasons, where, for example, there's a requisition that's issued by the clerk of the court to bring the accused to court, or where the status provider the prison with a warrant of arrest. He may have been on bail in another case, but because he's been arrested on a different matter, he has not appeared, so the court has issued a warrant of arrest. One of the dangers of this clause is SAS may use alternative mechanisms to ultimately achieve what they want to do. All they'll do is they'll ask the court, instead of remanding the person to DCS facilities, which are much far more adequate than SAS facilities, remand the person to the SAS cells for a specific period. So now what you've done is you've created a mechanism which the inspecting judge doesn't have any access to, and the SAS are able to achieve what they need to. Finally, let me deal with clause 9, section 49G, the maximum period of incarceration. This is a new aspect which hasn't been touched upon. One of the challenges with this particular clause is that it requires the appearance of an accused as an additional mechanism after 2 years and thereafter each year, irrespective of when the accused last appeared. So the period started on the 1st of January 1 year, or 2 years later. On the 28th of December, the accused appeared in court, and the magistrate postponed it for 2 weeks to continue the trial. This section requires the accused to be taken to court on the 30th or the 31st of December to appear in front of that magistrate to consider the issue of remand. But the magistrate has 2 days earlier than that already considered the issue. So we're creating an unnecessary court appearance. Every unnecessary court appearance has an implication. It means that there's less time to be spent on trial, which means it delays criminal matters. Another remark I might make is that the period doesn't run from the day of arrest, but the day of admission to the remand detention facility. What about the transitional periods? If I've been admitted to a correctional facility, which subsequently becomes a remand detention facility, does it only work from the date of a remand detention facility? Or is it calculated back to the correctional facility? We have a bit of a problem. What happens if the period was broken? Say the accused was admitted to remand detention facility, subsequently granted bail, forfeited his bail, and is back in remand detention facility. Having worked with DCS stats in the past, I know that DCS often revised the first number of the first date of admission. Suddenly it appears that the person has been admitted for 2 years, whereas in fact they've only been admitted for 6 months in total. That's I would propose that when the drafters look at this legislation and the committee look at the legislation, that we look at including something. We have to have a checking mechanism, which can include a clause which says, if they haven't appeared in court in the last 3 months, or some period which is appropriate, and the court hasn't considered the issue, hasn't had the accused person standing before them, that in those circumstances, those cases must go through. And you ultimately will achieve the review of the court, which is surely the intention of. Finally, 3 points. One, the reporting every 6 months to the DPPs of the NPA to say, well, these people have been detained 6 months, and then subsequently these people have been detained 6 months. It does not appear to serve a purpose. The section also looks inappropriate where it is in the particular legislation. I do suggest in the document that there must maybe be some alignment to sections
required the national director every 6 months to report on certain remand detainees whose trial has been stopped. Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense. What does the DPP do with the report? What is the purpose of the report? Is it a management tool? There's nothing required of the DPP in that response. There must surely be a logical link. Finally, just the final two comments. Section 43.4 of the Act incorrectly refers to Act 32 of 2005, which should be Act 38 of 2005. The opportunity should have to be used in the drafting of the bill to make that correction to the legislation. And in clause 1B, remand detention facility, the definition is based on the definition of correctional center. However, it excludes all land, outbuildings, and premises adjacent to any such place and used in connection therewith. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but if one was going to base on the definition of a correctional center, one would surely want to mirror that and not simply lose that particular clause. Thank you. My learned colleague Patricia has a few remarks on the medical issue.
Very important to the board will be the type of offense that is still a sentence imposed by
see this like you're using